I'd like this morning, if I may, to begin by turning your attention to James chapter 3, verses 1 through 12. James 3, verses 1 through 12. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn the whole body. Look also at ships, although they are so large, they are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is also set amongst our members so that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature. And it is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird and reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by man. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been created in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree bear olives or grapevine figs? Thus no spring yields both salt water and fresh. I think it's evident from our reading that the tongue is a mighty thing that can be used for good and it can be used for evil. But just exactly what do we mean when we refer to the idea of the evil tongue? Well, an evil tongue might be a gossiping tongue. A gossiping tongue is spoken of in Leviticus 19:16. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, and nor take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You don't want to be a talebearer. Well, what is a talebearer? Sometimes a talebearer is also identified as a busybody, somebody who's busy telling everybody anything they know and some things they don't know. 1 Peter 4 and verse 5, we recognize that is the case here. Whenever he says, if you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, a busybody in other people's matters, we are told not to suffer for doing that because it is an evil of the tongue. The gossiping tongue looks high and low for some juicy tidbit that it can tell somebody about something. So people find themselves, according to this, condemned with the murderer and the thief and the evildoer in general. The whispering tongue is a different kind of tongue. The whispering tongue is the one who, by definition, detracts from others by exciting suspicion against them, by dropping subtle hints or making insinuations that they are evil. And such is often done in secret. And such is done slyly. The wise man, by inspiration, in Proverbs 16:28, said that a perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends. A whisperer separates the best of friends. This well describes the action of the whisperer. Paul describes those who refuse to have God in their knowledge in Romans 1 verse 29 as being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, and are whisperers. Notice the category that's placed with. Whisperers. I don't think there can be any doubt that whispering tongue is an evil tongue, and consequently it has no place in the mouth of a Christian. But there's also the slandering tongue. The slandering tongue is a tongue that utters false reports with the intention of injuring the reputation of another. In the 101st Psalm, in verse 5, God, through David, says, "Whoever secretly slanders his neighbor, him I will destroy. The one who has a haughty look and a proud heart, him I will not endure." Now, notice what God said. The man who secretly slanders his neighbor, I will destroy. God doesn't have any patience with such a person. In James 4, in verse 11, we find another reference to this when he says, "Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law." What are you doing when you slander somebody? Well, you're trying to make them look bad. You're trying to make them look evil. We need to keep in mind an important factor here, and I don't know if you very often have thought about this, but very often you'll find that the slanderer who secretly says something to you about someone will turn around and say something about you to them, to someone else. They're going to say evil to you about so-and-so, but then they're going to go out there and they're going to tell somebody else, "Well, he said this and he did that." They really have no discretion whatsoever. They are slanderers, and the slandering has no place in the mouth of a Christian. But there's a tattling tongue. The tattling tongue, the word tattling comes from two Greek words that mean to babble and to prate against. I don't know about you, but I'm not too much into prating. But prating is defined as chattering or telling or repeating idly, quite bluntly, to blab. Now, I know that. I know what that means. Also, it describes a foolish, idle talker, which is often the source of great exaggerations. The wise man in Proverbs 10 and 8 wrote, "The wise in heart will receive commands, but a prating fool will fall," or "he will be laid low," as some versions say. This is one of the sins of Diotrephes that's recorded in 3 John, verse 10. John says this Diotrephes, who was a man that wanted to have the preeminence amongst them, was always prating against people, and especially against the apostles. This, of course, was done with malicious words that he used, and to try to discredit them and to make himself look good. We need to keep ourselves from such foolish talking, lest we be found to be guilty of prating against God. Then we find another evil tongue is a backbiting tongue. Now, this is an interesting tongue. This word backbiting comes from two Greek words. And as you might guess, it means to speak evil and against. Now, that's real simple. But it's a description of one who speaks evil of someone behind their back. In short, it describes a coward. A person who will say evil things about you to someone else, but wouldn't dare say it to the person. They're a coward. This is something that is a danger. And in the 15th Psalm and verses 1 through 3, we find David dealing with that type of a person. And notice in verse 3, "not backbite with his tongue," or their tongue. You're not supposed to be doing these things. The 2 Corinthians 12 and 20. Paul said that one of the things he hoped not to find in Corinth, notice, he hoped he didn't find this when he came there, was, you got it, backbiting. Backbiting. Romans 1 and 30, in the list of things that characterize those, again, who refuse to have God in their knowledge, what do we find? Backbiters. 1 Peter 2 and verse 1. Peter says, "Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, evil, or envy, and evil speaking. There's no place for this in the life of a Christian. Peter says it has to be laid aside. We have to grow as babes on the milk of the Word. And there's no place in the mouth of a Christian for such talk. Then there's a cursing and swearing tongue. The words simply mean, swear, invoke the name of a sacred being in an oath, to use profane or obscene language. And that definition is the same in the Greek as the English. Cursing means to use profanely insolent language against. I'll get it all out here. To blaspheme. Now, the same definition in Webster's, same definition in Greek. So we don't have any difference in the language here at all. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 34, Jesus says, I say unto you, swear not at all. Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for the city of the great king, nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no be no, for whatever is more than this is from the evil one. Now, what does that tell you there? You just simply put it like it is. You tell it like it is. Your yes means yes. Your no means no. You don't have to say that you don't have to say, by God, this is true. By the temple, I swear, this is true. Or so on and so forth. None of this is necessary. Jesus says that we are to simply state what is the truth. Leviticus very plainly brings this out. Nor shall you profane the name of your God. No profanity is to come forth from our mouth. In Matthew 26, notice if you will, in Matthew 26, we find the idea of cursing and swearing there. This is the very way that Peter made it known that he wasn't one of Jesus' disciples, because he was cursing and swearing. So it is. All those today who are cursing and swearing are making it very evident that they're not a disciple of Jesus Christ. They're not a disciple of Jesus Christ, although they may claim to be. But you say, well, Christians don't talk like that. And you're correct. You're correct. They don't, and very seldom will we find someone who claims to be a Christian who is being absolutely profane and vulgar in what they say. But what we do find are euphemisms. Euphemism, according to Webster's Ninth Dictionary, and it may be a word you're not familiar with, euphemism is the substitution of an agreeable or inoffensive expression for one that may offend or suggest something unpleasant. In the early days of radio and television and the movies, that's what we heard instead of four-letter words. They would say darn and gee and gosh and things like this. That was the vulgarity was being toned down. And that's something that they allowed. Unfortunately, because of this, many Christians picked up euphemisms innocently. They heard them on TV, and they were nasty things, and they just thought they were part of the language, and that's what they began using. And they incorporated them in their vocabulary. I am convinced and confident to a greater degree that all who sincerely desire to please God will remove these from their language when they find out what they really mean. Now, I want to make known that the definitions that I'm going to be giving you of these euphemisms are not my own. These come from Webster's Dictionary and more recent ones from a place called dictionary.com, which you can go to several different sources for this, but these are just two of the places that I consulted. It's not my opinion that it's offensive. It's not my opinion that it's sinful in God's sight. It's a fact. And so we're going to look at it. Euphemisms. What's a euphemism? Well, one euphemism's darn. Now, there are three out of five definitions that are given for this word that have nothing to do with mending socks. That's for some of you old timers, okay? But the third definition under this word is an adjective. It is a euphemism for damn or damned. Number four, it is a verb for damn. Number five, it is a noun for damn. So when you use this word, what are you saying? Well, there's no other way to put it. You have no place in your mouth for that word. But you hear it all the time on TV and movies and things. In fact, you hear a lot worse in movies, I'm afraid. But it's a very common thing, and it needs to be eradicated from our vocabulary. The word heck. You hear that a lot. I hear it a lot whenever people find out I'm a preacher. All of a sudden, all the hells become hecks, you know. And they think they've cleaned up their language for me. But, you know, the word is defined in the dictionary as a noun and a euphemism for hell. And by the way, it's been used this way since 1860. This dictionary is interesting in the respect that it gives an indication of when the word was first used that way. One may try to make their speech less offensive by using it, but still they are saying the same thing. Well, what about, gosh, a very common phrase amongst people is gosh. It is an interjection, but it is a euphemism for God, and it has been since 1757. It's nothing new or recent. It is used as a mild oath or to express surprise. A common phrase that we hear nowadays is, oh my God, or OMG. Now, no matter what you think it means, that's what it means. And whenever you put this on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you put it, that's what it means. Personally, if anybody forwards something to me and it's got any comment on it with that in it, I delete it immediately. I don't even look at it. And I might also add several other abbreviations, some of which I would rather not define. But when I see WTF, I delete it. If you don't know what that means, ask your kids. They know what it means. But people are using it. And we're kind of strange people if we don't. But think about it. How can anyone justify a mild oath? That's like saying a little lie. It's just a little lie. Well, you know where all liars are going to have their part, according to Revelation 21:8? In the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. So that's no excuse for it at all. It doesn't belong in the language or the vocabulary, I should say, of a Christian. Another one we hear, and we hear this one quite often, G or G's. This is another word that is common amongst people and thrown in as an interjection and in very often in conversation. But it's a euphemism for Jesus. And it has been since 1895. And it doesn't matter what you think you mean by it. It doesn't matter. That is what the word means. When you say you're taking the name of the Lord in vain by swearing and saying Jesus, well, you're doing the same thing when you say Jesus. You just shortened it. There are a couple of others that some people say are not euphemisms, but indeed they are. One of them is shoot. It has nothing to do with pulling the trigger on a gun. The word shoot is a euphemism for expletive deleted. I'll leave your imagination to that. And it has been since 1876. It is used to express annoyance or surprise. This is one of them that I picked up myself years ago. I heard my favorite grandfather. I had a favorite because he played with me. But I had a favorite grandfather, and this is a phrase, a term that he used all the time. He didn't know what it meant. He just said it. But dear ones, that is what it means. That's what it means. And it should not come out of our mouths. Another one that is really popular amongst people is my goodness. Did you ever stop to think what that means? It doesn't mean, my, I'm so good. That's not what it means. You know that. What does it mean? Well, it means, my God. According to the dictionary, it says that goodness is a euphemism for God. And so, a phrase like my goodness or thank goodness, think about what it's replacing. Instead of saying God, you're saying goodness. Think about it. If a foreigner who was not very conversant in English were to come into town, and he would hear you talking, and every so often you said, oh my goodness, this, and good, thanks, or thank goodness for that, or thank goodness for this, he'd go, well, what does that mean? So he goes to his dictionary, he opens it up, and he says, a euphemism for, that's it! Now I understand what they're saying. You didn't mean that. But it's what the definition is. Now you can holler and jump and scream all you want to about some of these, but the fact is the fact. The definition is this, and you're saying it. That's an important thing, isn't it? We try to think of all kinds of ways to justify the way that we talk. And I know that all the people that I've ever met, and me included, who picked up some of these words are trying to think of some way to explain it. I know that because I was there. But I want you to read from Matthew 12 and verses 36 and 37. I'll have it on the board, but read it from your own Bible if you have it in front of you. But I say unto you, for every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. Now, what were you saying about words just now? Oh, it's not important what you say. We know what we mean by it. Really? By your words you'll be justified, and by your words you'll be condemned. You may say it doesn't matter what words you use, but I'm sorry. Jesus says that it is important, and that we're going to either be justified or condemned by our words. Brethren, this is a serious matter. It's a serious matter. And one, by the way, one that reflects back on the church. People in the world, believe it or not, people in the world know this. And I know some denominations around who teach the same lesson on this I teach. Why? Because it's a truth. Now, what do they think whenever they hear you, a member of the body of Christ, using those words? They say, what a joke. They think they're going to heaven. They're using the Lord's name in vain. Think about it. And don't tell me it doesn't happen. Because it does. Now, how can we be sure that our words are what they should be? I don't think I could turn to a finer place than Luke chapter 6 and verse 45 for this. A good man, Jesus said, out of the treasure of his heart brings forth good. An evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth evil. For out of the heart, the mouth speaks. What's in your heart comes out your mouth. So, if we want our words to be pure, what is the secret? We have to have our heart pure. We have to be sure that it is absent any of those things. Well, how can I be sure that my heart is pure? I really appreciate that song you led this morning. First one we sang, Pure in Heart, O God. That's just full of good, important thoughts for us to consider. But turn over to Philippians 4 and verse 8. And here's how you get your heart pure. Philippians 4 and verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. That's how. If you're meditating on these things, there's no place for that in your vocabulary. You don't have any place for it. But that kind of brings us back full circle to the righteous tongue. We've been talking about the evil tongue, but what about the righteous tongue? The righteous tongue is a tongue that is used to confess Christ. He commanded us to do it in Matthew 10:32 and 33. And Paul said we must do it in Romans 10 and verse 10. Now that's a good use for the tongue. Good use, indeed. The righteous tongue is also used in comforting one another. Paul says that we are to do this in 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 18. And the righteous tongue is used, you heard it, to spread the gospel. Yeah. Use that tongue to spread the gospel. Jesus, and to his own disciples, told them to go into all the world and to make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Yeah. That's a good use for the tongue. How's your tongue being used? Think about it. How is your tongue being used? And while you're thinking about that, I want to remind you of this verse. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be. As simple as that. And that's talking to you, and that's talking to me. The thing is, we have to hear it and heed it. Brethren, I brought a lesson to you this morning that's probably going to make some of you mad at me, and that's okay. I've been mad, had people mad at me before, but I hope that you care enough about me to set me down and show me where I was wrong. If you can't, I hope you're honest enough to make some changes in your life. That's all I can ask for.